was great talking to you.
Thank you very much.
Bye. And you're listening to KBOO Portland, and coming up next is Preference.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Spontaneous Combustion New Music Festival, happening January 19th through February 10th at the Old Church in Portland. The Spontaneous Combustion New Music Festival features 7 new music performers, performing works by living composers, both well-known and lesser-known, as well as some works by recently deceased 20th century composers. Music by Lou Harrison, Jacob Druckmann, Julia Wolf, David Lang, and many, many more. Again, that's the Spontaneous Combustion New Music Festival, happening January 19th through February 10th at the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 35th Annual Real Music Film Festival, taking place January 12th through January 30th at the Northwest Film Center. New works and classics are featured this year, including Charles Mingus, Triumph of the Underdog, Chavela, Long Strange Trip, The Untold Story of the Grateful Dead, The Big Beat, Fats Domino and the Birth of Rock and Roll, and many, many more. Again, that's the 35th Annual Real Music Film Festival, taking place January 12th through the 30th. All screenings are at the Witzel Auditorium in the Portland Art Museum, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome, dear listeners, to Preference Radio here on KBOO. That was Tusk, a little different version, but tubas, how can you resist tubas in a rock song? I'm here in the studio with Emery Colvin and Sean Brown. Before we start our conversations today, I want to make an announcement. There's lots of great events. I'm very excited. Penny Arcade will be here next. Let's see, the first. So next Thursday, By Hook or By Crook will be shown on Wednesday evening. There'll be a discussion of Jack Halberstam's book, In a Queer Time and Place, as part of that event. So go ahead and look on the web for information on those. The first is a PNCA event, Penny Arcade. Actually, I think there's four appearances by Penny Arcade starting on Thursday next week, and Pika is hosting that over in their northeast space. There's also Pinkwashing Exposed. This is a film, it'll come with a discussion as well, about Seattle area activists who worked to expose the Seattle's mayor's participation in this campaign to pinkwash Israeli war crimes against Palestinians. We've aired this in the past. I strongly recommend it. A sense of how city governments and activists, and also this pressure from Israel or its representatives in the U.S. So that showing is on Thursday, February 8th at the Fifth Avenue Cinema downtown in the evening. I also want to remind folks that Portland has a sister city relationship with Ashkelon, which was a Palestinian city until Israeli tanks rolled over it in 1948. So if folks want to think about how to pressure Portland's city government to withdraw participation in that sister city relationship, it's pretty simple process, but they need to, city council needs to hear that it's important to folks. Okay, we're going to chat with Emery Colvin first. Emery, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, I am a second year PhD engineering student at Oregon State University, and I've been very involved with the Coalition of Graduate Employees, which is our graduate employee union, and working on our health insurance, specifically about getting health care for transgender folks. I guess it kind of goes back about a year when we were having issues getting coverage for some procedures, pretty divided along gender lines, trans men were not having as much problem as the trans women getting coverage. So it was really, really obvious that that was a bias happening there, because pretty much anything for trans women was getting labeled cosmetic, which doesn't follow any of the international, you know, standards of care, and also was just, you know, not right. So, you know, we started hosting town halls, started pushing through the avenues that the union had to try to get this rectified. Through our collective bargaining contract with the school, they're obligated to cover, you know, our insurance. And I will say, like, it is very amazing insurance. I have the best insurance as a graduate student right now than I've ever had before in my life. But the school provides it and does all of the negotiations for it. So we don't have control over exactly what it looks like, just over the fact that they have to cover it. So, you know, we started pushing. We were hoping going into the 2017-2018 year that they would fix a lot of the issues that we'd brought up. We got our plan, and it looked even worse than it had before. So we sent out a press release to, you know, local media outlets, and it kind of has disseminated farther, obviously, up to Portland. The school got right on it. So, you know, it took sending out a press release, but once we sent that out, it definitely got fixed really quickly. So they've been really responsive. You know, the school took it very seriously at that point and fixed. They put in a new rider correcting our insurance, and also have been, you know, dedicating some more training to their caseworkers. There's now one advisor that does most of the trans cases to make sure everything is, like, they know what they're doing, and, you know, they've really, really been on top of things since then. So we've been really encouraged by that.
Oregon State is a public school.
Yes.
So does state law factor into the kinds of care for trans folks who are participating in the school system? Does that factor in?
Yes, it definitely does. Because that was one of the things they were telling us about why it had changed for, you know, this recent years, was they're like, oh, well, the laws changed, we had to change stuff. And it's like, yeah, but you didn't have to take away coverage. You could have just changed the way you worded it, which was ultimately what they did later. And that was one of the arguments that we put forth, was, you know, one of the requirements as students is that we have to have either our insurance through the school programs, or we have to prove that we have equivalent or better insurance on our own. And even OHP was being considered not equivalent. So, like, OHP wasn't good enough, but OHP would be covering these procedures for people. So we're like, all right, you say OHP isn't good enough to be equal with this insurance, and yet you're not covering things that OHP does.
So there's a requirement to have insurance?
Yes. Yeah, all of the students have to have health insurance, which is not super new. Like, I did my undergraduate many years ago in Georgia, and we were also required to have insurance in the early 2000s.
I think when I was going to Portland State, the most we could get was a flu shot, and you could see a therapist like twice, and they would send you on your way.
Yeah, and I will give a shout out to the Portland State Grad Union that is trying to get their first contract negotiated, because they're, you know, looking at the health insurance that the graduate unions at U of O and OSU have got, and they're like, why can't we have health insurance too?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Benton County.
So Benton County has some interesting stuff going on. We've had two, last I'd heard, and maybe more now, at least two of the early court cases for non-binary gender identity. I was the second. And then, you know, we've got a pretty active transgender support group. Both, like, there's some resources to the school, but we also have one that's just in the community, run by community activists. And I think they're actually listening from a potluck tonight. So there's, you know, there's a lot of, you know, support within the community for each other.
Let's talk about this court case.
Yeah. So, I reached out to, one of the lawyers in Corvallis, who's done a lot, supporting the trans community, who, you know, offered to do my court case. And because you can't use, at least then, you couldn't just use the standard. It still, I think, uses the term sex change, even though that's not really what anybody else uses anymore. But you couldn't use the standard paperwork for non-binary. They would only accept it for a binary gender change. So you have to have someone who can navigate all of the paperwork that you have to have. So she did that, and I got a visiting judge. So we kind of went into it with no idea what to expect from this judge who, you know, the second thing she said to us after complaining about when we filed the paperwork was to criticize the grammar of my pronouns. So that started that off with a, you know, very exciting moment of, oh no, am I gonna, you know, is she not gonna sign this just because she doesn't like my pronouns? You know, I use they, them. And, you know, she's like, well, it's just not grammatical to use them for singular, you know, even though it goes back as far as, you know, Chaucer used singular they, them. So go figure. And yeah, so, you know, now it's just the uphill struggle towards, you know, everything is still so binary. You know, for Social Security, I had to pick, you know, originally for my driver's license, I did. But, you know, I was one of the people early on that testified at the DMV hearings about the need to have the X on our driver's licenses in Oregon. So that was great that we got that through. My passport is in limbo right now because I'm trying to get them to put an X on it. And part of that is, like, I rely a lot on my passport because I was born in Texas. So getting my birth certificate updated is not really going to be in the cards for me. Even if it was a binary change, Texas won't do it unless you have had full reassignment surgery. So
I want to mention your sweatshirt.
Oh.
Which reads, an individual of mysterious and indistinct gender.
Yeah, a friend sent me a link to this, and I was like, all right, well, I've got to order that. Since moving out to Oregon, I found that I did not have near enough hoodies for Oregon winters.
How did you end up here?
So I had been teaching for a couple of years in Atlanta, where I'm from, and the school I was teaching at closed. And at the time, I was teaching as contingent faculty, which is an adventure in and of itself, because you really never know when you will still have a job and when you won't. And so once that ended, my best friend had just moved out here. I was like, you know, Oregon State has a really good nuclear engineering program. My best friend's out here. I need a change. I was about to start transitioning, and, you know, it's kind of nice to just start all of that in a completely new place where it's not, you know, struggling against people that know me one way and are insisting on continuing to think about me the same way. So, yeah, it's kind of just a good chance happening.
Tell us, let's go back to the trans support community in Corvallis.
Yeah, a lot of it is, you know, support group meetings. Some of it's, you know, social. We'll have potlucks. just random gatherings. We've got some, you know, really awesome trans musicians in the community. You know, and just anytime anybody needs something, you know, you can post to one of our groups, and usually there's somebody around that can help. You know, I have a truck, so I've definitely been the, you know, when somebody has spontaneously gotten thrown out of their housing situation, because trans people overwhelmingly have, you know, a lot of housing insecurity, you know, we've got that. You know, I can show up and help people move on the drop of a hat. We have a food pantry. So it's just, there's just a lot of support within the group for, you know, anybody that needs anything. And we get support from other groups as well. You know, different groups will hold, you know, food drives for us and things. So just, you know, in a lot of cases within the, with the trans community, you know, we have a lot of experience with not being able to trust other groups to help us. So we help ourselves.
Let's go back to the question of insurance. By the way, folks, you're listening to Preference, an Experiment in Queer Radio. I'm your host, Alan. We're talking with Emery Colvin of Oregon State University, who worked to turn Pacific Health, is that right?
Pacific Source.
Pacific Source. I know they're separate organizations, so I should keep it clear. Pacific Source to provide comprehensive trans healthcare to graduate students, is that right?
Yes.
And does that affect healthcare for undergraduates?
So the undergraduates, I believe, have their insurance. I think it's through Aetna. It's through a different. We're the only ones. Like, so the graduate employees have our own insurance. Although I think the fellowship students are also on our plan. They're kind of in this weird limbo state where they're not part of our bargaining unit, but they get a lot of the same benefits we do. And I know at least I think some of the faculty are on Pacific Source also, but it's a different plan. So we're a fairly small plan that's just the graduate students. I hope some of this echoes through the rest of Pacific Source's policies with other groups, but I don't know for sure.
I think I hear a little bit here and there about graduate students organizing.
Yes, that's been a really big movement because especially as we've got a lot more people coming back to school, you know, after having, you know, working for a few years or whatever, you know, we're not relying on our parents anymore. And with the rising costs of, you know, life and the rising costs of education, you know, we rely on having some level of income, and we can't take, you know, the peanuts that often get thrown to graduate employees. Like, we have to have health insurance. We have to be able to feed ourselves. We have to find housing. And, you know, like in Oregon right now, housing is terrible. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not only does that give us power to, you know, actually ask the universities to pay us something that we can live on, but it gives us more power to support each other. So, you know, like within Oregon, we've got three locals right now of graduate students. So there's U of O is the oldest. I think they formed in the 70s, actually. Oregon State formed in 99 with their first contract in 2001. And Portland State right now is working on their first contract. So the three of us have really started working together a lot to try to support each other and to coordinate a lot of stuff. But grad locals all over the country are coordinating a lot on supporting each other through things and supporting new locals that are forming, because we face a lot of the same issues, both between like living and dealing with Nazis that show up on campus. That's one of the big topics that's been discussed lately, because they're increasingly showing up, and we're having problems all over the country with that.
Mm-hmm. How does that work on a college campus? We have this experience in Portland where, you know, it's, I don't know, the streets are public. I imagine mm-hmm. on a university, it's somewhat different.
I mean, we kind of function similar to any public sector union. So, you know, when our contract's in effect, we can't strike, at least for ours right now. You know, so, but, you know, the streets are public on the campus. So if, but a lot of it we do through negotiation. And our experience with the university hasn't been super antagonistic. You know, we definitely have our issues, you know, with certain things, but, you know, overall, you know, they want it to be a better environment also. So we all work together.
When you sent out this press release, when the graduate students at OSU sent out this press release calling for the university to push for comprehensive trans care through Pacific Health.
Pacific Source.
was the press release, the release of the press release itself enough, or did it spark conversation in the community that
it did some of both. We had a response from them basically within a day. Mm-hmm. That they were on it. And so we got a very, very, very fast response from them. So, you know, just the fact that we sent it out to people was enough to get them started fixing it. But it was also a good opportunity for us to publicize the issues that we face in getting insurance, you know, with for all of this stuff. And because this is not an isolated thing, you know, this is something that's faced by people all over the country in their insurance. So it was a great, like, educational moment also.
Mm-hmm. Do you have last thoughts, Emery?
I think, you know, as people, you know, go about their lives, you know, just keep this sort of thing in mind, you know, where in, you know, whatever work you do, where are the barriers that trans folks are going to face? You know, where are the barriers that non-binary folk are going to face, you know, as they navigate structures? You know, why, you know, if you're requiring someone to put themselves in the category of male or female, why are you requiring that? You know, what purpose is it serving? So it's because it's something that the trans community on its own can't fix. This is something that's going to have to come, you know, from everyone else.
We've been talking with Emery Colvin of Oregon State University about trans life and trans community in Corvallis and beyond. I want to thank you so very much.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. We'll be talking with Sean Brown in just a few moments. We're going to hear a little musical break. Looking fine, bring the small town. All right, welcome back to Preference, dear listeners. That track was Anna Blue by Blue Angel, the group in New York that Cyndi Lauper got started with, 1980 maybe. That was a digital recording from vinyl. I'm here in the studio now with Sean Brown, local filmmaker, superstar, makes things happen. Sean, do you want to introduce yourself?
Well, hi, Alan. Thank you for having me back. It's lovely to see you again. And hi, all you boos out there. My name is Sean Brown, and I am a local filmmaker here in Portland. And I'm here to talk about my new one. It is called Strictly Professional. And Alan's giving me the... Keep it going, Sean. Keep going. Keep talking. it's called Strictly Professional. And it is... I think my opus. It's the best one that we've done. And by we, I mean this time I had a crew. We had a cast of 42 actors, and so it marks a big change from my previous films, where really it's been a one man show with a few friends thrown into costumes, and now. The one immediately previous to Strictly Professional was called Radio Silence. Radio Silence also marked a bit of a change for me in that I moved from more experimental filmmaking to more narrative, and that one was surprisingly successful. For it was a very dark and gloomy picture. Everybody was miserable, and then they died. So. but nevertheless, it was surprisingly successful, although not in gay and lesbian film festivals, because I presented a representation of same-sex family that was in the throes of a domestic violence crisis, and that just didn't really play too well in the LGBT film festivals, although it did in one festival in Ukraine. I think they thought it was a comedy or something, because of the success of that, it got a grand prize in Berlin, it got some notice locally, and because of that, it led me to a wider affiliation with the local Portland filmmaking community, which opened up opportunities to meet people who then came on board based on the strength of this new script that I had for this new project called Strictly Professional, and lo and behold, things happened, and we are just prepared to screen the premiere screening for the new movie February 18 at the Clinton Theater at 4 p.m. And then there will be a second screening on March 11th at 6 p.m. also at the Clinton Theater. And the this film, all my films have been kind of issue oriented in one way or another. There have been films about gentrification, domestic violence in same-sex families. There was an interracial, intergenerational lesbian relationship that was the focus of my first film, Cocoon. This film is, on the face of it, is not necessarily a gay-themed film. It is a straight story, I guess, but I don't know really how to categorize that particular aspect. The story is a kind of a Harold and Maude sort of story for the millennial age. It is a coming of age story, but it's the person who's coming of age is not the one that you think is bound to come of age. It's not the young person coming of age, because the story, Strictly Professional, pokes fun at white privilege, at prejudice, at assumptions that people make. And so this is the story of three wealthy Portland women who each of them have problems. The lead, Suzanne, her husband has committed suicide. Her friends, Gloria and Titsy, are also a little issue of conscious, of focused rather. Gloria has this disease that is questionable and is in its authenticity, called Morgellons, which is some kind of thing that comes out of your skin and you have to pick at it. So she's a little bit quirky that way. And Tizzy is a lady. She's getting a little older. Her biological clock is ticking. She wants to have a baby really bad. But if she has a baby out of wedlock, she'll probably be cut off from her family money. So these women decide to solve their problem by hiring young black gigolos to take care of business. And they want to do this on a strictly professional basis, not develop emotional relationships, but their plans go awry. And they come to a head, their assumptions and prejudices and privilege comes to a head when Suzanne meets and falls in love with a young man named Kevin Cox. No double entendre. And I'm getting the keep talking, Sean, look with those sultry bedroom eyes that Alan has. So... As I said, this is kind of a Harold and Maude type story, and the reason is because there's a great age difference between our romantic leads. Suzanne is pushing 60, and Kevin is 19, and they have they meet and have a beautiful relationship, although it's a paid employee kind of relationship, but it goes beyond that. The movie has become a focal point in my life these past 6 months, as my family can attest to, and it is probably the most romantic, sweet story that you can imagine, and it is also hilarious. Some of the casting that I did with this project is what makes it more of a Sean Brown film, because while as I've laid it out, it's a fairly straightforward story, but in the same conceit that Strangers with Candy had the character of Jerry Blank return to high school as a 47-year-old hooker, and nobody really notices or ever mentions that she's a 47-year-old freshman in high school. I have cast drag queens as characters in this story. One of Gloria, one of Suzanne's best friends, is played by a brilliant actor in from Atlanta, Georgia, called and his name is Sean Marlowe, and he does the role of Gloria, sort of like a Lee Remick on Quaaludes, and he's genius. Local drag clown performer, legend, superstar Carla Rossi does a turn as the nemesis of our lead, Suzanne, and is genius. Mm-hmm. she is absolutely brilliant in this. And then there's another young drag queen who has a smaller role, her name's Saturn, and also does a great job. One of the differences that I mentioned earlier is that people came on board of this project, which is makes it different from my other projects in terms of having a crew, and some I've been fortunate and blessed to be working with some really amazing talent here in town. The film is being scored by a local band member. The local band is called The Coffers, and the man doing the score is Jim Meyer. We had costumes done by a very, very talented young woman named Miriam Tallis. And my second hand in this whole process. He's been a real rock, somebody I can really depend on. It was my director of photography, Cody Harper of Lucid Heights Film, and he's been, you know, with the project from pre-production all the way through post-production, and has worked to bring this to the screen, and has done a great job.
Wonderful. Let's go back to your history as a filmmaker.
Okay. Anything in particular?
No, just start in about how you... Tell us about how you got started making these films. I mean, it's first and foremost a labor of love. So,
well, it is that, yeah.
Something that I think can really inspire folks to say, okay, I don't need to bring a whole wagon train over the mountain.
Right. Well, thank you for bringing that up, actually, because that's kind of what got me started doing it, because, you know, I'm no spring chicken, and I've worked as a writer for many, many years, and it's very difficult to get a project up and greenlit and funded, and I really was only seeing things from that Hollywood perspective, from the perspective of submitting and waiting for a yes. And finally, there was a project that I was working on, and it was up and down and up and down, and it got so close. I remember I used to own a restaurant, and I remember I was in my restaurant working, and I had the radio on, and Howard Stern was playing, and Sandra Bernhardt is on the Howard Stern show talking about how she's just about to go into production with my movie. It was a very exciting moment. Did that happen? No. It got about 2 days away from production, and it fell apart, as these things do. So when that happened, I just kind of got tired of it, because at that point YouTube had been out for a few years. It was a thing that, you know, and you know, previous to YouTube, there was no such thing. It just became apparent to me in an aha moment that it was possible to that I didn't just have to write a script. I could actually make a movie if I wanted to. And so I wanted to see what I could do for $500 with easily accessible equipment. So I bought a $50 camera from off of Craigslist, and I made three movies with them. Those movies have been shown all over the world and have done really surprisingly well in the festival circuit. And each one of those movies had a $500 budget. So the entree to the industry is not so difficult an obstacle that any young filmmaker can't achieve that vision. With this one, I upgraded. I got rid of the $50 camera, and thanks to Open Signal, which is up on MLK, I had access to really fantastic equipment. So I shot this on a Canon C100, or actually Cody shot it on a Canon C100. We had great sound recording equipment, and it made a huge, huge difference in the technical quality of the product in the end. The budget still hovered around $500. It was actually $750, but all of that goes to food, because you got to feed 42 people and they get hungry, and so we, you know, as you mentioned, it is a labor of love, and everyone who came on board as a volunteer, and that was over 50 people in the end, and so it was a major effort for a lot of people, and it pays off brilliantly. I hope you all come out to the screening on February 18th at the Clinton. The tickets are only $7. So this is we just went to see Star Wars recently, and I think I don't know how much we paid. It was like $20 or something for a ticket, and it was a good movie. You know, kind of long, but this is something that I think will really set the bar a little higher for independent film here in Portland.
That's awesome. Now, Open Signal, that's part of Portland Community Media.
Is that is right? Correct. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a terrific resource. I love those guys. They're so friendly, and everything is so accessible. You know, you take a couple of classes, it qualifies you to use some equipment that that was beyond my reach without open signal. So I'm indebted to them for this. Beyond that, the music that we have in this film, there's an original score, as I mentioned, that is composed by Jim Meyer, and then there are also three songs in the film. The theme of the movie is really boils down to one song, which is played at the beginning and at the end, two different variations called "Woman Pennywise." "Woman Pennywise," "Something for Me," and "Did You Know" are songs that are performed by this phenomenal singer named Gemma Bulos, who lives in Los Angeles, and she'll be coming back up for the premiere. So yeah, everybody is going to be at the premiere, you guys. The whole the cast, the crew, and we are making fun of some white privilege and having a good time with it. So come on down and tell us what you think and have a couple of laughs. And let me know if you think I hit it right with that with the tone of the comedy.
And that is February 18th at the Clinton Street.
That is right.
And then a second screening at the Clinton March 11th. You're listening to Preference. I'm Alan, your host, and I'm here with Sean Brown, filmmaker. Let's go back to Radio Silence for a bit.
Okay. Radio Silence. Shall I tell them who the cast was?
Yeah, starting with Nick. I think the meat of the story is really in the family dynamics.
Radio Silence was a story that was banging around my head for a long time, and I avoided it for my second film because I knew it was going to be very dark, and you know, you kind of live with a movie alone in a dark editing room for a very long time, and this one, as I mentioned, was kind of hopeless, you know, because I knew how it ended, and the cast of that was a local performer named Nick Matos, who did a fantastic job. He was a first-time performer in a film. There was also a professional actor named David Basila from Los Angeles, who came up and did that. We had a young man named William Luke Burton, who played the son. And it was these two guys, and they the story picks up where they were having a rough time of it, and in the middle of a domestic violence situation. One of the guys is beating up on the other guy, and in front of their teen son. And so you can imagine this creates some an unhappy house. Well, at the same time that this is happening, there's also a terrible apocalyptic event that happens, and no one really knows it. But headed toward Portland is a terrible nothingness. It's a biochemical, 100% lethal, airborne, apocalyptic thing that's headed our way, and the only information that we're getting from it is via the radio, and we have two radio hosts who are bantering throughout the movie. And they are really if there's any lightness or comedy in it, it is due to those radio hosts, and they do a really amazing job. And I'm sitting next to one of the actors right now, Alan Silver. Allison May was the other, and they did their best OPB radio hosting. And in any case, that movie was done in black and white in a real George Romero visual style. And as I said, it really kind of took off in some overseas festivals. Took grand prize in the Berlin Festival and led me to be able to do this very ambitious project, Strictly Professional, which I believe is going to pay off greatly. This project, I can't say enough about it in the sense that of how proud I am of it. It is something that just about everyone will be able to come in and enjoy. It's a little like as if John Waters directed Breakfast at Tiffany's. The character of Suzanne, the lead, is like a grown-up Holly-go-lightly. And if you saw Breakfast at Tiffany's, the characters there in this movie, they're dealing with some issues, and there's some parallels to young people in the 60s, what young people are like today, and just, you know, wanting the finer things in life. And now my Holly-go-lightly, Suzanne, has achieved that. She has everything that she wants. Or so she thinks, but she doesn't. What she needs is some humanity, and she finds that in this new project. And it's, whereas my previous films have been fairly niche, this one is something that you can play. You can put it on at Christmas or at Thanksgiving in front of the family.
Tell us about working with Carla Rossi.
Carla Rossi was an absolute joy to work with. So professional. I was really impressed with Anthony throughout, and he was on set, on time, in makeup, and ready to go every single day that he was needed. Performed brilliantly. I can't even cut away. There's one scene, his last moment as Carla Rossi, her last moment in Strictly Professional. And really, I should just give the last moment to her and cut away after 2 seconds. But I can't, because she's so good. So it stretches out and I just can't cut it. Everything Carla did was fantastic. And cutting her, I don't know if you've ever cut a movie before, but sometimes when you're cutting a movie, you really kind of have to sew a lot of things together to make a cohesive appearance. And never with Carla. She was always right on target. Awesome.
Carla is all around town, hostess of Queer Horror in particular, regular, I think every 2 months, feature film at the Hollywood.
It's really fun.
Yeah. And just lots of projects, always. A lot going on. Who else?
The lead actress, who is a beautiful and very talented woman by the name of Grace Rothen. There is Sean Marlowe, who I mentioned, who came from Atlanta. And then the third lead is a woman named Jenna Van Valen from Vancouver, who I think this is her first movie, and she steals every scene. Every scene, she's just amazing. Well, she's got her character's name is called Titsy. And so that isn't what... It's not why you think it's Titsy. So stop thinking that, Alan. I can see that. The character's mother is a former model and kind of celebrity, much to her parents' horror. And she has an affair, and she goes through an Asian phase, and so she names her daughter Titsy, but yeah, everybody just ends up calling her Titsy. So. And then the mother actually gets electric shock. And the mother in that movie is played by my mom, my real mom, who is actually really adorable in it, and she let me put a dog collar on her because the character Mommy goes through all of this, becomes a model, and has the baby and everything, and then the parents put her in an asylum and give her electric shock during the punk era. So she's never come out of the punk era. So now she's a 70-year-old woman, but she still, you know, has the Brian Eno t-shirt and a dog collar and blue hair and black bandit sort of eye makeup and so my mom was really kind of adorable as that. And also, my daughter's mom, Rebecca, is in the movie. So, you know, with 42 in the cast, you know, I have just about everybody I know in this movie. I'm surprised you weren't in the movie. Were you in this movie? I can't remember.
Not as far as I know, either.
Well, you never can tell. Do I have me on my camera now?
Radio Silence, if folks want to go back, is on YouTube, I believe.
Radio Silence is available on YouTube as and it's a shortened version from the festival length, which makes the pace move along a little bit faster. I also have Boo Demon versus La Cerveza de Muerte, and that's available as a short 13-minute version. My partner John, who is also in Strictly Professional and in fact demanded a bigger part in this movie. He prefers the feature length Boo Demon, but Boo Demon is a really crazy experimental one, because that one it was a Lucha Libre movie parody, and I just kind of basically had the actors accounting, you know, or just saying nonsense, and then I threw a jacked Panamanian pieces of dialogue from Panamanian movies that had nothing to do with what was going on. The dialogue had nothing to do with what was going on visually. And then my subtitles, again, had nothing to do with the Spanish that was being heard. So, and what was weird about it, believe it or not, it didn't really do that well, except in Spain and Mexico. In Spain and Mexico, I got letters from people who'd seen it saying how much they loved it. Which kind of cracked me up. And then Cocoon is also available on YouTube, and it is there's a 20-minute version, but I think the feature length is really good. I was lucky. I got permission to use some really cool music in that, like Homicide by 999. When I asked them if I could use their song, they responded in a way which I cannot quote, even though it would be presidential if I did. And then also Space gave me sort of a tacit permission to use their song, the deadliest, what is it called now? I forget. The deadliest creature, the female of the species.
Oh, yeah.
Female of the species, yeah. And so anyway, yeah, that's there's good music in Cocoon, and it's a really fun kind of crazy, it's sort of my version of an Andy Milligan movie, and I don't know if anybody knows who Andy Milligan is, but he's an old 60s, early 70s exploitation film director, and that was my first movie. I'd never made a movie before, so I wanted to see if I could make a movie, and I didn't want to fail. So I thought, well, if I make a movie like Andy Milligan, no matter how it comes out, it won't be a failure. And it turns out that it actually was really fun. Turned out to be a good movie, and very in keeping with the Andy Milligan style too. So, But Strictly Professional is definitely a more it's a serious film. It belongs on Netflix. I'm so excited about it. It's really fun to make a movie and to write a script, have it in your head, and then go to the theater and see it on the screen. Mm-hmm. This one is gonna make me piddle.
That's Strictly Professional. It'll air for the first time at the Clinton Street Theater on February 18th. If you need to see it twice, it'll be there next on March 11th. Sean Brown, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'll talk with you soon.
Bye.
Time is 7:01 and you're listening to KBOO Portland, and coming up next